And it's a transcendent Tuesday morning, just about time, 23 and a half past the hour, to bring in Dr. Don Clark here. Don, the only biochemist on the staff here at Broken Road Radio. Well, you don't mind me saying you're on the staff here. You're not going to, like, ask for a paycheck or something, are you?
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I've been looking for one for what now? What, 8, 9 years?
9 years, yeah. Yeah.
As another member of the staff says, keep looking.
It's in the mail.
It should be here any minute now.
Yep, any minute. Right. Yeah, it's in the mail. I keep looking in the mailbox and I don't see it, but who knows? Maybe it got sent to the wrong place.
Then again, maybe not.
All right. Before we go any further, mm-hmm. I would like to make an announcement.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
I have special information that I'm sure everybody in the world knows, but on this day in history, well, November 24th, what's today?
That's
23rd?
Today.
Yeah, today, that's today. Yeah. That's November 24th. Origin of Species was published.
Well, hey.
Is in 1859. Today,
wow.
Today in history.
Very good. Is that
interesting or what?
That's more than a coincidence.
I think so.
Be talking about what we're going to be talking about today.
Look what it did here for us here. We're talking, Don, by the way, not only a biochemist and a vintner, but also a member of the board of Creation Moments, where there's all kinds of information about the biblical story of creation. Creation, the operative word there. This particular article simply asked the question, how can you refute evolution? And it's kind of a duplicitous headline because it goes on to explain how you can refute evolution. And last week we had a topic of we were talking about scientifically developed knowledge as opposed to false knowledge, and how science really develops findings to support wild guesses. And if there's enough support over the years, it graduates to hypothesis and then to a theory and then to a law. And it's under a very rigid set of circumstances. It demands a lot to become a law of nature. Evolution just kind of skipped all that. And somehow, with the publication of that book, it considers itself settled science. And so we asked the question, how do we refute that? Why does it make sense to so many people? Don, that's your bailiwick.
It doesn't look like that big of a book either.
No.
Yeah.
It looks kind of a small book.
Oh. You know? Well, yes, this is a... how can we refute evolution? The answer to the question is easy. All you need to do is just look around you, and you can see that the complexity of the world around us. Now, it's interesting that during Darwin's time, when they looked through a primitive, we would call them primitive microscopes, when you looked through, and looked at cells, all you saw was the protoplasm, and you saw a nucleus in eukaryote cells. You said, well, you know, there's just a goo and stuff in the middle between the cell wall and the nucleus. So it looks like everything's just kind of jammed in there. And it looks like it maybe could have come from, you know, a conglomeration of chemicals that was once in the primordial soup or in the sea. And they just naturally attracted to each other, and they came together and they formed this cell. And then, voila, life began. That's kind of the story that the evolutionists would like to tell you. And the reason why people have latched on to the theory of evolution, and it's not a theory, by the way, as we talked about last time, because if evolution is true, then we can explain everything in the world from a materialistic point of view. So you get into materialism. And you get into, we don't want to put faith or God into the equation. And so therefore we can explain everything about the world through a non-God, mechanism or process, or just by natural processes. So all of this obviously came together through natural processes, or not. And so how can we easily refute this? Well, you can easily refute it because one, biological systems, as we said, is very, very complex. I don't care what level you're looking at, but let's take the macro level first. And so you take the macro level of a fish, because evolutionary story would tell you that the fish, you know, went to birds and went to turtles and, you know, eventually apes and then finally to humans. And you can go into pretty much any natural history museum today. And what you see in many of these museums is a monkey kind of hunched over, kind of walking, you know, on his hind legs, and then the monkey gradually starts standing upright, and finally you get to man, a kind of a hairy man, and therefore, voila, we've just proven evolution to you, and here are the transition forms that we just made up in between. And we'll, you know, we talked about, you know, Piltdown Man and Australopithecus and those other supposed transitional forms between monkeys and man.
Neanderthals, but, and all those, huh?
Yes. And we talked about the Neanderthals actually some time back, mm-hmm. And they were probably more direct descendants of Noah that had migrated north. But that's another story altogether. Anyone can refute evolution, and all you need to say is, look, you know, how can a fish, let's just take the example as they've taken here, how can a fish, you know, go to a bird, or how can a fish go from living in the water to living on land? Let's look at some of the body systems and body parts, okay? The first is the fins. So you got to change the fins into little feet. And, you know, in that process, if you just think about it logically, changing fins into little feet, well, fins are designed to move the fish through water. Well, feet are designed to walk on land. And so, therefore, you can't really, if you, you know, change the fins into feet, then the fish can't swim very well. And if you didn't change all the fins into feet and then put two more in the back there.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here. Now I'm going to speak on behalf of evolution. We evolutionists suspect that the intermediate species between fish and mammals had both fins and feet. So there, deal with that.
Oh, okay. So it could do both at the same time.
Now it's true we found no such evidence, but you know what I mean? That whole Origin of Species book could have been summed up in the one word you used a moment ago: voila.
Yes, voila indeed.
Voila. And, it is finished. It's
you
done.
Know Darwin, yeah. Of course, in his Origin of Species and Natural Selection, and it's a very racist book, by the way. He used
502 pages, by the way.
Yes, he uses the finches as an example of how we can change from, you know, how evolution works. And you get finches with small beaks and finches with large beaks. And he found these on the Galapagos Islands when he visited there and was a naturalist on board the ship, and you know, drew a lot of pictures, and then comes home and writes his book after several months, of course. But you know, a finch going to a finch is not evolution. A finch with a small beak going to a finch with a larger beak, because okay, things dry out, and during the dry season, the fruit or the food that the bird is trying to eat is more towards the ground and is harder. The casing is harder, so it needs a tougher beak. And so the birds with the thicker beaks then survive, and the birds with the thin beaks that can't open the food, of course, don't survive. But when it rains again, and when things get wet, guess what happens? Well, the population then shifts back to birds with the smaller beaks. And so it's just God's creation, of course. He gave us the ability to have much variation within a kind in order to handle environmental changes that, you know, we see from time to time, or constantly, actually. And so he created the finch from the very beginning that had the ability to have different sized beaks depending on the environment it was in. And that's exactly what we see. It's not evolution. It's just in the gene pool. And you are selecting out a certain of the gene pool according to the environmental conditions that you have. So that's not evolution. But going back to the fish issue, you say that, okay, let's make feet and fins at the same time.
Sure.
Well, that would mean that you would be doubling up on the bone structure. Someone can say, well, okay, let's look at a fin. It kind of looks, there's a joint in the fin, and so it kind of looks like maybe that could be turned into a foot at, you know, some point in time. But when you have both of them together, you have to create out of nothing, by the way, new bone structures that don't exist. And so there you go. You've got creation going on, if that's what you believe, instead of evolution, and you somehow say, well, you know, given eons of time, we can duplicate the bone structure and have little protrudings that look like little feet, little pads that are going to come out, and eventually that turns into little foot pads, and voila, the fish can climb out of the water. And then once it's out of the water, it loses its fins and everybody is happy. And with the exception, of course, you have to now change the gills into lungs. So how do you do that and still keep the fish in the water long enough to develop the foot pads? But, you know, you're trying to, at the same time, develop lungs in about the same place where the gills are, and so and somehow change the gills into lungs, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Matter of fact, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so if you truly look at the creatures around us and what has been created by God, you find, for example, that things haven't changed over periods of time. And actually, on today's Creation Moments, I was reading today's Creation Moments. We have the ancient termites. There's a petrified tree that was actually found in Big Bend, Texas, our part of the country, out in West Texas, Big Bend between Mexico and the United States, and there's petrified tree where they found these octagonal shaped petrified pieces of wood, and there was tunnels in the tree, and after examining these things, they said, oh, voila, these were created by termites. Well, the petrified tree is dated back to the dinosaur period, and so not only did the hexagonal little pieces of wood which are excrements from the termite eating the tree.
I see.
And the tunnels that were created in the tree look exactly like termites do today. It's like, hey, things haven't changed in millions and millions of supposed years. And so we have a little bit of a problem then, saying that on the one hand, things are constantly changing within the biological systems, but on the other hand, they're not changing at all. So God has designed, of course, things to have variations within a kind. And I think we've covered this on previous programs. What is a kind of animal and kinds of animals? For example, you've got the horse kind, and you have the dog or the wolf kind, and the dog and the wolf are in the kind of the same category, and basically any animal or any species that can reproduce with another species is in the same, you know, kind of animal, but just because it doesn't necessarily can reproduce with a with another kind of animal that might look similar, for example, a rabbit. There are northern rabbits and there are southern rabbits, and then there are rabbits in the United States that are in the middle, and the northern rabbit can't breed with the southern rabbit, but both the northern rabbit and the southern rabbit can breed with the central rabbit, the rabbit that's found in the central part of the United States. So they are obviously of the same kind, even though the two extremes have lost the ability to breed and successfully breed with one another.
Where's the evidence of evolution then? Because that's what we talked about last week as well, the standards of evidence. And I understand it's possible for two different scientists to interpret evidence differently and reach different conclusions. But I have yet to see evidence for evolution, because they say it all goes back to something called the missing link that no one's ever been able to find. And I guess that relates to chimpanzees to man, though, but... Yeah, David.
Haven't you seen the little diagram?
Oh, that's
that you
right.
Can buy and you can stick on the back of your car, mm-hmm. and it starts with a little puddle of something, and then it slowly grows into a Jedi Knight.
I've seen the tree of life, where all these species are connected by branches. I mean, it's very
right.
creative.
Yes. And even better.
So that's in the imagination of man, and not in the, you know, not that we find that in reality. It's in the imagination of man. Now, there are those folks that are molecular biologists, evolutionary molecular biologists, that are taking a little bit closer look within the cell, within the cells of various species, for example, or various kinds, and saying, voila, you see, this enzyme, this DNA is pretty similar to this other DNA over here, and these two species are pretty far apart from one another, so they obviously must have had a common ancestor in order for the DNA sequence
you're seeing they're geographically distant, right?
Geographically, and maybe for example, for a long time, they said the pig is quite closely related to man. Mm-hmm. So the DNA from a pig, for example, can match to a certain degree the DNA of humans. And they would then purport that somewhere along our heritage was the pig. But just because you have common similarities in parts, for example, in molecular parts and molecular systems, doesn't mean that one evolved into the other, and doesn't mean we came from a common ancestor. All it means from the macro level is that, hey, that system works, and so God created that system to be in multiple living organisms. It all depends on if you're coming from a bottom-up type of thing that evolution tries to do, or if you're coming from a top-down perspective that creation does. You can say anything you want, but the evidence is the evidence, and the evidence that we have, for example, is they used to say that monkey DNA was 98% similar to human DNA. And because of that, that proved that, you know, man came from apes. But when they got really right down to it, the variation, the deviation between the two species were tremendous, because all they were comparing were the DNA that actually expressed proteins and not the what was at once called junk DNA, all of the stuff in between. Well, it turns out that humans have a lot of stuff in between the actual coding regions of the DNA, and that stuff in between actually is all of the control mechanisms that we need in order to live, in order for the cell, you know, for a liver cell to be a liver cell.
This kind of goes back to your representation from the Origin of Species and the primitive microscopes, and you could see a cell, and so you're looking at the stuff in between the nucleus and the cell wall, and you're saying, well, it's just stuff. That's a glittering generality. And the same error applied to their view of DNA. Well, it's a chemical, which masks all the tremendous detail, the power of DNA, because I'm tempted to call it not a chemical. It works via chemistry, but it's life is what it is.
Well, it's of course, DNA is called the library within our cells, and it has all and contains all of the information that makes us. For example, your DNA is slightly different than my DNA. We're both humans, and we're both have two ears and two eyes, and so forth and so on. But our DNA is going to be slightly different because I'm expressing my DNA, and I look like me, and you're expressing, and you look like you. And God did make a way for slight variations to be able to be accommodated in our DNA so that no two people are actually exactly the same, which is really interesting because you've got your DNA, and you have two copies of your DNA, matter of fact, within each cell. And because of that, then you have this ability to preserve the information that's in the DNA, but at the same time, give it the ability to express in different ways in different people. But yet, you're not going to cross over from, you're not going to go from a human to a monkey, although we're seeing some of that in politics today, of people actually doing that. Being serious for the moment, that's just not going to happen because God designed us to stay within our own kind of species. And it's interesting that from an evolutionary point of view, of course, we can look at the different races and we can say one race is more advanced than the other race. It gives us an excuse to say that. But if you say that every human on Earth comes from the original Adam and Eve, then that is saying that there is no difference between you or me or someone else with a different skin color or a different, some may have slanted eyes and some have higher cheekbones. And that's just an expression, different types of expression of the DNA that was once in Adam and Eve, for example, and that were all from the same initial parents. Which, ultimately we're, of course, we're all from somebody from Noah's ark and from Noah's family. But we're all related. So you can't say that races become immaterial at that point. So from a creationist point of view, and from a Christian biblical point of view, races are immaterial and don't have any validity. Yes, we look different, so it's a phenotypic, difference, and we have different cultures, and we have different, we eat different foods, and thank God, we've got, Korean and Asian and Italian and all French and all this different, beautiful, created different types of foods. It doesn't make us, different from the basic nature of us. We are still man. But from an evolutionary point of view, of course, they would say that, the races, of course, that shows that some have evolved more than the others. And so that gives someone the right to rule over someone else.
Which brings us to something we have discussed here before, and that's this nature of mutations between generations. And in that sense, creationism is just the opposite of evolution, because we have pretty well demonstrated in past discussions, I think, that each of those mutations with each succeeding generation is a degeneration, not an improvement, not a progressive change. But and now we're back to Dr. Don's theory of devolution, which
we always get back to that when we talk about evolution.
Well,
it's the
truth. Dr. Don,
you're going to be famous eventually. Don, you'll be famous.
I guess I'll have to die first, I suppose.
That'll be the same mail package as your check.
I'm waiting.
CreationMoments.com, that's the website for Creation Moments. Donna is a board member there. And there is quite a library of information, an archive of digital information and printed information, books available that support the biblical story of creation. Be a good place to visit and spend some time, CreationMoments.com. Don, again, we're thankful. We'll check in with you next week. Have a happy Thanksgiving, okay? And celebrate with your family.
You folks too.
All right. And keep social distancing, okay? Just thought I'd say that.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Absolutely.
Bye-bye.